low grade, slow grade, slow cooked church changes you in ways that you cannot imagine. And if you say, well, we're going to this service 1 week, and next week we're not really going to go because we're going to the holiday house, and the week after that we've got a sport event on, so we'll go to the service that we don't normally go to, where we don't know people. And don't be surprised if your teenagers don't end up Christian, because you've shown them a vision of human flourishing that doesn't really need Jesus.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Hello, you're listening to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity Magazine, the UK's leading Christian magazine, and we bring you news, reviews, opinions, and more every month in print and every day online. Check out our subscription offers right now at premierchristianity.com. But today, here on The Profile, we speak to a different Christian each and every week and hear something of their life story and their faith journey. I'm delighted to say that my guest this week is Stephen McAlpine. Stephen is an Australian writer, church planter, and speaker. He's the author of Being the Bad Guys: How to Live for Jesus in a World That Says You Shouldn't. And most recently, he's also authored Future Proof: How to Live for Jesus in a Culture That Keeps on Changing. And I can tell you that I have read Future Proof, Stephen, and as you know, benefited hugely from it. And that's one of the things that prompted me to set up this conversation. So I'm really looking forward to hearing some more from you today. Welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you across the miles and a few hours time difference. So I won't be at my peak, and you might be. So I'm ready for curly questions.
I have to confess, Stephen, that we've not had that many Australians on the show. I'm confessing my sins right now. And when I looked at the time difference between us and setting up the conversation and the logistics, I then realised why. That actually finding a time both of us could do is not easy when you are on completely different time zones. But thank God we've managed to make it happen today, which is great. Why don't you take me back to the very, very beginning? Tell me a little bit about life growing up. What was life like for you?
Well, I actually was born in Belfast, so that's interesting. And I've seen Belfast, the movie, and I took my mum to see it, and she thought it was a documentary and laughed the whole way through. My dad was from the back streets of Belfast, and we moved to Australia in the early 70s. My parents were married by the Reverend Ian Paisley and were members of his church for 6 years. So it was a really... So we left and came to Australia. There you go. And very different. And then we went back. No, when I say we, that was my twin brother. I have an identical twin brother. And we grew up in a very, that kind of background. You come to Australia and it feels a very different beast. Australia felt like the other side of the world. No, it felt like the moon. And it was just as sandy in Perth when we landed as the moon. You move, very different settings. So we bounced back to Northern Ireland in the height of the Troubles in the 80s. So growing up was a funny time, I think. It was one of those... am I Irish, Northern Irish, or am I Australian? Never quite tell. And so we acquired other brothers, my brother and I, along the way. And my parents divorced when I was 17 when we came back to Australia at some stage. So lots of moving around and discombobulation, I think, till about the age of 17, or when my parents split up, and then mostly living in Australia for Stephen. But we all sort of scattered, I think.
Yeah. What was the reason behind your parents moving from Belfast to Australia?
It was a classic 10-pound poem, look for a better life. Belfast, for my dad, he never really liked it. And he was there in the height of the 70s bombing campaigns, and his workplace was blown up. And they just wanted to start something different. And I think they wanted to just dial down the level of intensity as well in Northern, that their Northern Irish experience was. It was very different, though, coming to Australia, which speaks the same language, but it's a completely different world. And it felt, for my mum, even going to church without a hat on was a weird experience. And our other friends from Northern Ireland had moved ahead of us, and they were the pastors of the church, and advised my mum after week one, don't wear a hat, you'll be fine. And it was just although it's the little things. It's like Winston Churchill, I think, was it said that the US and the UK are the same, sort of culture divided by a common language. And it felt like there's enough the same and there's enough different. And that was always kind of the way it was. But for a 7-year-old or 6-year-old, growing up near the beach in Perth isn't the worst thing in the world after living in Belfast, to be honest.
Yes. Yes. And one might imagine the culture of Belfast and the culture of Australia, as you say, are very different. Of course, there's a shared language, but one might guess that the kind of culture of Northern Ireland would be a bit more, at least at that time, a bit more restrictive or strict in some ways, and Australia perhaps a bit more loose. I mean, were you aware of that as a child? Can you think back to examples of how these were two sort of quite different worlds?
Yeah, well, I think when we went back to live in Northern Ireland at the age of 13, I noticed in our setting at least, it was much more strict. But at the same time, we had a good church experience when I was back for 2 years, a very good youth group. Shout out to Portadown Baptist Church. which the interesting thing is, I've become Instagram friends with the pastor there, and I know and read a lot of things from Northern Ireland. And what I have to be careful with is that my view of Northern Ireland doesn't atrophy in the early 80s, because I see great videos from Baptist churches where there's great music worship and fantastic baptisms. And I go, I took my wife to Northern Ireland in 1999 and she loved it. And I was still waiting for it to be like the old times, and it wasn't. So all migrants atrophy their vision of whether it was good or bad of the old country. And I realized that it's moved along a lot. And I've got friends
Yes.
from Northern Ireland. It's very different. So I'm very aware of that. And the way Christianity engages with the culture in Northern Ireland is obviously very different now. And it's almost reaching that post-Christian framework as well that the rest of the UK and Australia has. And it just feels like a different, it's a different place. And I haven't been for years, but just my social media understanding of it and people I know, it just looks very different, I think, than it was.
Yeah. So tell me a bit more about the kind of faith that you were brought up with. Sounds like you were kind of a church goer. Your family were going to church from an early age. Tell me a bit more about what that Christian background was like for you.
It was just assumed that we go to church together, and that we went to mainly a Baptist church in Australia, mainly. And it was the simpler times in the 70s, where it was church twice every Sunday, Sunday school in the morning. In Northern Ireland, Baptist church, it was Sunday school in the afternoon, church twice. I can't ever remember not believing the gospel, but I do remember deciding at the age of 8 that I was a sinner who needed to repent and believe the gospel, which I did. And it's interesting having a twin brother who never really had that framework as much, even though he's sort of assented to it. He's not Christian at all. And look, he's pretty open about that. We've been on Australian podcasts, Christian podcasts, to talk about the difference in our lives, because he's a fairly well-known academic in Australia. But growing up, it was a simple, what I do remember a lot is my mother was very good at having lots of people around on Sunday for lunch. And if there's one thing I really enjoyed about my upbringing, it was how quiet and chilled out Sundays were after church, where we would spend hours with other Christian families having lunch and playing games with the kids and chilling out. It was a gentler time, and it was a less filled in time. And in Perth, for example, everyone in Perth was asking, this is how unreconstructed Perth was. What's it like in Northern Ireland? Did they have coloured television? Okay, we're streets ahead of you. But one thing in Perth was everything shut down at lunchtime on Saturdays, and Sunday was a much softer, quieter experience. All my non-Christian school friends were playing sport on Sunday, but we would never do that. And so I got a good grounding in Christianity in terms of cultural, but I don't know how thick my understanding of the Bible or how it was put together was at that stage in my life, I think.
Even so, enough at the age of 8 to recognize you were a sinner and needed Jesus is in some ways remarkable, but actually for a lot of people who grow up in Christian homes, quite normal really, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't begrudge that at all. I'm not the guy who wishes, oh, I wish I'd spent 40 profligate years destroying my life before I met Jesus. There's wisdom in becoming a Christian early. It saves you from a lot of things through Jesus saves you from a lot.
Yeah. And looking back, have you ever kind of wondered how it was that sort of two twins, you got a twin brother, could grow up in pretty much exactly the same environment with the same parents and same church and sort of come to two totally different conclusions? You're carrying on in the faith and your brother isn't. I mean, is that the sort of thing you and him have talked about and wondered, you know, what is it that led us on two totally different paths despite having the same kind of upbringing?
Well, you know, it didn't really surprise me given I know the story of Jacob and Esau, but neither, but we look the same, so I guess that's not so much they didn't, I guess. I guess it has. I think in life at 50, nearly 57, you look back and you go, incremental decisions take you in different directions. And my twin brother and I talk about it, and we have talked about it publicly in a podcast that people were intrigued by, because we're very close, very similar in the way we speak, in the way we think. Politically, we're a bit divided, but we see the world's problems through the same grid. And people would not be able to determine who was speaking. If we were both speaking at the same time, but you would not be able to tell which one was which. And so he lives in the other side of Australia, in Sydney, but I see him a lot and we're very close. So we'll argue, but we always did. But twins are, you do see how the Jacob and Esau thing works psychologically as well. To tap into my inner Jordan Peterson going through Genesis, in that how you psychologically engage with each other and how that shapes you in so many different ways, that perhaps you decide to go different ways after having to be dressed by your mum the same way for 12 years. You take very different paths. And so as much as there's a theological understanding of that, I think there's a psychological understanding of that as well for me.
Yeah. And your parents divorcing it, I think you said you're in your teens, did that have a big impact on you and you both at that time?
Blew us out of the water. We had two other younger brothers, much younger by that stage. My dad left my mum just before we started university, which was very destructive of us. Church was hard. I ended up in a more Pentecostal church for quite a few years. And one of the reasons, I think, was that it felt like it was very okay to be obviously a mess. I hate to say it, but, and there was nothing that was untoward in my church that I went to, but it felt like it was okay to be a mess in the setting that I ended up in. And that shaped me a lot. In fact, both my twin brother and I ended up going to different churches after that event and finding cohorts of people who were friends with us and kept, in fact, one I met last week in Sydney as well, who has been a friend it's nearly 40 years, 40 years since that time. And I go, wow, good friends are hard to hold on to, but good church friends can be amazing. So it did shape us and change us, and it threw us into figuring out who we were. And we come from working class stock. My dad was a factory worker till he died, you know, well, after, you know, he'd retired. But and my mum is left school at 14. And we both got an education in Western Australia free of charge in a country that is classless, or it was at that stage. And it's a very different experience in one generation to what our parents were like and what their parents were like. And it was Christians just checking in on me all the time and then meeting other Christians who seemed, you know, they were pretty chill about my life experience. That actually kept me going, but in God's grace. So that was good. But just that education thing changed us a lot as well.
It's often the way you speak to people who have grown up in church and, as you say, perhaps not had that crisis of faith or wandered away and become a prodigal for a few years, but more or less consistently stayed in church. And it's often the case that it's people point to, well, I had a fantastic group of Christian friends or people who were involved in my discipleship or just looking out for me. And that sense of a real community, it keeps people in church. I think especially, as you say, when you go through difficult things, you talk about your parents divorcing or just other stuff that can come up in teenage years. If you've got that solid community around you, it can make all the difference in keeping you in, can't it?
Well, it's incredible. And I've noticed the same with my daughter, who's a, you know, great, strong Christian young woman. And the great thing for her was those younger women, and not always just younger, but the 5 to 10 years older than her women who looked after her at church and she wanted to emulate. And she gets to university doing a, you know, a literature and history degree, and everything's on tap at university for a world without God. And she goes, no thanks, I'm good. You know, I don't need to have a picture of human flourishing that you create, because I've got a good one here. And I think back that's what kept me, I think. You know, that was God's means to keep me in place during some difficult years.
Yeah. So if I'd met you at 18, 19 and said, what's the plan for your life? What do you want to be? What are you pursuing in terms of a career? Would you have said church planter, speaker, Christian author, or would you have said something different?
I'd probably said journalist or writer, I definitely would have said. I did a degree in creative writing and journalism, but very unsure of what I wanted to do. And it only took me a year to be a journalist in a Christian network in Perth, actually, and which is still going and which I'm still good friends with people, to realise that's not what I wanted to do. And I don't think I was a very good journalist anyway. I wasn't brave enough to shove the microphone in everyone's face, though I had to do it. It just wasn't me. But at 18, 19, 20, university was big. You don't go away in Australia to university necessarily. You can go to the university in your local area, and many do. And Australia is vast size. So you're not going to go to necessarily 4,000 Ks to Sydney unless you've got a position that you've been gunning for. You can do it in the university of your city. So you don't leave home, which changes things because England you do. So I was unsure what I wanted to do, and I did the degree and then sort of chopped and changed. I did go back to Ireland, then the England for a while, and then came back to Australia. So it felt like the 18 to 24 year age for me was very much resettling the ship in the ocean after the storm of my parents divorcing, because that really did throw us a lot, I think. And so I wouldn't say they're the lost years, but they were years where I chopped and changed things quite a bit, as you do, but it felt like with little stability.
And what happened next?
Well, the great irony is a friend of mine who has worked in radio, Christian radio and secular radio in England for a long time, was working in a church, a mission church. It was a big city church, which was very different theologically to where I was coming from. And I went to visit him after I got back from England, and he said, oh, they're looking for a youth pastor in this church. You should apply. And I said, well, I've only run youth group in church, but I've never done anything like that. Out of the blue, I got it. I can't believe that. And it was the first stable job I got, I think, for a while. And it was very different theologically. I don't think they believed the convictions I had about the gospel. But I did one, well, as I started there, and I was feeling, where's life at? I'm getting my feet under the table there. And my mum and brothers had moved back to Ireland for a significant period of time, 5 or 6 years, and I was by myself. I just started to find a little bit of direction. And also one Sunday, a young woman walked into the church who I went, oh, I could marry her. And I did. Here we are 28 years of marriage later. And she's also a migrant from Cape Town. And it's interesting being two migrant people in that setting who you come and you forge a life where your parents have decided to come to a foreign country, not to make life better for themselves, but to make life better for you. And that's been interesting. So I suddenly realized that I could communicate well in that setting and the people listened. And that was kind of weird, right? But I did realize at the time I didn't have much Bible framework and I needed to get some, because it's one thing for people to listen to you. It's another thing for you to have something to say that's worth listening to, especially if you're going to get up in a pulpit and preach it, or a youth group leader and speak it, you know? And so that was my tension at that moment. What do I do next with that?
Right. So you recognize you needed some more theological and biblical understanding. So I guess, did that naturally lead into a kind of Bible college back into studying?
Yeah, that's the great irony. You do your first degree and you think, I'll have some fun. But by the time I was doing a theological degree in a small but now much more flourishing place in Perth, I was, this is serious. Put your feet under the table and study. I still had fun, but what I liked about it most of all was that the people who led it, particularly the principal, were exceptionally gifted Bible teachers and teaching the big picture of the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. And they gave me the story in full, I think, of what I had in piece form growing up. I knew the stories, but when I saw the big story, I was like, yeah, this is how it fits together. Coupled with that was a confidence in the Bible that it could be used for, as Paul says to Timothy, all those things, for reproving, training, correcting, leading us in righteousness, and having a confidence that it wasn't just based in my conviction about what the Bible was, God's word, but what the Bible could do. It could pastor and change Christians to live more like Jesus and do so as it was unpacked and lived in their lives in community. And that was important. So that my training, I loved it. I, you know, 3 years, got married in the second year. My wife was also doing a bit of study. So we were dirt poor, as you are. And, but who cares, right? That's fine.
Yeah.
And I look back 28 years later to the incrementally easier life you have financially and think, wow, we really did start it with nothing. And how did we get here? And so that was interesting. But my wife married me as an introvert. She's an introvert. She's a friendly introvert, but knowing I was going into full-time ministry, and that's always been both a comfort and a challenge, I think.
Yeah, tell me a bit more about that, because I can imagine just the way that we mentioned church being community, and that can come with it quite a lot of sort of social occasions or even expectations or obligations on pastors and pastors' wives to sort of have an open home and have everyone around. I imagine if you're a bit more introverted, that kind of idea could be a bit scary.
Yeah, and I think those things have changed. My mum's a hospitality beast. My wife is friendly and hospitable, and she's a full-time clinical psychologist. And she's been involved in church planting, whether in our household or within small buildings. We've planted churches in our house. We've had everyone over at our house. And that's taken a toll on her, I think. Not in a bad way, but I could see her servant heart in that. And one thing that's happened, marriage does this. I guess I was the Labrador puppy dog of, yeah, I'll have every relationship around. And she was more like the careful, you know, not the Rottweiler, but watching and going, let's be careful. And somehow along the line, you become a bit of both each. I think that's what marriage does. So, yeah. But that partly that's me going, how do I sustain, help her be sustained throughout marriage and life and ministry? And she's going, how do I direct him well so that it'll, so it's been good like that. And we've done deep house church in England. We've done household church in Australia, and we've led large multi-staff team, or I have, while she has been with me. And that's worked in all those settings, actually. Our preference probably is just that we do good community in church where it's sustainable in the context in which people are living. And if they're living in a high rise, intense, dense living city like we lived in England, and we want to do household, that's fine. And if you're living in a dormitory suburb place like Perth, where everyone drives to work and school and the place is empty, we'll meet in a building. I don't care. We don't care. We're not about that. We're about the gospel in that community in its context.
I was going to ask you, because you mentioned being part of large churches and smaller churches, and obviously you have a lot of experience in ministry. Have you found yourself believing, you know, one of those is better, or one of those is ideal? You know, have you found yourself over the years? I mean, I remember speaking to someone who for a long time was really pushing into the kind of small church, house church, and just had kind of given up on the mega church model, and actually thought the mega church model was really wrong. Said, look, they don't do community properly, and they were really pushing into small church. And I met this person a few years later, and he said, Sam, I've been around some of these mega churches, and I've had to work with them and meet the leaders, and these are really good people. And actually, the mega churches are doing some really good stuff. So, you know, have you been on that journey yourself and your wife a little bit in trying all these different types of churches and sort of seeing the benefit on all of them, or where have you landed on that?
Well, that's, you know, I'm the Nirvana age cohort. So we're the X generation people who, you know, boomer church isn't going to work. We're all going to meet in our houses. And 20 years ago, all the books in the bookshops, Christian bookshops, were on how do we do church? Because we don't want to do it like, and let's break it down and anyone can lead a church in your house. And we burnt a lot of people out with that. And my experience of big church has actually, it's not about the size of the church. It's whether it's able to create good networks and structures that allow humans to flourish as Christians. And small church can be as toxic as a big church can be positive. And I have friends in both, and I've worked in both. And my experience of big church is that as long as it's got the structures that allow people to do smaller settings, it can be fine. I also think that household in certain places doesn't work. If you went to, mostly in Perth, Mostly, but not exclusively. If you say to people, why don't you come to my house and meet some Christians? We're going to do church there. They'd be, maybe you should meet in a building. But the great irony is so many people were telling us 20 years ago, sell your buildings, meet in schools, meet in halls, meet in community centers. Community centers and schools are now a little bit shy about letting evangelical churches meet in them because of the whole culture war stuff and because of diversity and inequality and inclusion documents and things like that. So 20 years ago, we predicted a future where people would be kind of disinterested in church and we could reinterest them with funky kind of church in pub. And now I think people are interested in church in a different way, sometimes a little bit hostile. That's what my first book was about. But also there's a return to, hey, can you show us something older and thicker and deeper and richer than TikTok? Can you give us something that goes back a bit? I think there's a reinterest in church in our cultural setting, even if it's different to 20 years ago.
Be great to dig into that a little bit more. You mentioned your book. Let's talk about that as well. Being the Bad Guys: How to Live for Jesus in a World That Says You Shouldn't. I mean, this is still a very live topic of debate, even amongst Christians, because it really cuts the heart of how we do mission a lot of the time. You have some Christians who say, let's be winsome and let's engage the culture. And let's be just really, really careful and polite, and maybe avoid some of the difficult issues like around sex and gender, because that's a bit tricky. But let's just be nice to people, and we can win people. And you have other people saying the culture's changed. People hate us. You're not really going to change that. Let's just be a bit more aggressive and on the front foot, and let's not hide what we believe. And I guess you, I mean, your book is in the middle of some of that debate. It's recognizing that we as Christians are no longer liked or respected than we were maybe 20 or 30 years ago, as the title says, being the bad guy. So just tell me a bit more about why you wrote this book and what you were hoping to achieve through it.
Well, yeah, exactly. I wrote it. How do we get to the stage where people could look at a church and say, it doesn't matter how smiley you are, doesn't matter what kind of funky music you play, I don't care if you've got tattoos, and but your view of human flourishing, particularly around identity and meaning, purpose, sex, gender stuff, is actually not only wrong, it's bad, it's toxic, and it's not where we're going. And Christian schools in Australia are experiencing that at the moment with a huge Religious Discrimination Act kerfuffle around the same issues. That says, we think you're harmful and your theology is harmful to the vision of human flourishing that we're putting forward in a post-Christian age. So really the book was saying, and this is interesting that it still sells a lot of copies because people are still getting into this. Oh, I just got, the classic poet philosopher of the United States, Mike Tyson, said everyone's got a plan until they get a punch in the mouth. And people are feeling like, I could be winsome, and then someone goes, "You're not just wrong. You're a bigot." And you go, "How do I answer that?" So the failed strategies of assimilation, I will just go with the flow on this sexuality stuff, doesn't work because, as Trevin Wax and Carl Truman both point out, anthropology is the big question being asked at the moment. Not just what is a human, but what is a human for? And I would also say, who is a human for? If it's about me and personal identity, then the Christian message of you are not your own, you're bought with a price, therefore glorify God with your bodies, 1 Corinthians 6, is dud. And it's not just dud, it's bad. And so I wrote the book too for Christians to realize that it's always been a little bit like that. It's different in its post-Christian experience to pre-Christian experience, but the paradigm of the Bible is suffer now, glory later. And we're never going to get away from that.
Which of these topics has not been covered on PremierChristianity.com? UFOs, near-death experiences, Doctor Who, Christ's return, the faith of celebrities, and Andrew Tate? Trick question. We don't shy away from any topic. We cover faith as it affects us in daily life and give you the bigger picture. PremierChristianity.com. Special podcast subscription offer at PremierChristianity.com/podcast.
It sometimes surprises me actually how late parts of the church have been to realize this. I still meet Christians in the UK who perhaps not fully cognizant of how much culture has changed. And maybe it's because culture has changed quite quickly. Is that the problem, that actually we've gone from a culture that's been not necessarily massively open to the gospel, but one where there's been quite a lot of healthy respect for Christians. We've shifted quite quickly away from healthy respect to then thinking, no, you are the bad guys and you're wrong and you're evil. Now, of course, I'm painting in brush broad brushstrokes. This isn't everyone, but it has surprised me how I think still a lot of Christians in the UK think they're operating in a world where culture is more warm towards them than actually the culture has been.
Yeah, and so they expect a seat at the table, and suddenly they don't get one, and they expect that people will be, oh, you Christians, you know, you're part of the solution, get on board. And they go, actually, we don't think you're part of the solution. We don't actually need you. And you know those human rights you gave us that you say are from Christianity? Well, we can take those without your Christian bit. In fact, you don't even live them yourself. And that I show examples of that in the book. And if you don't get that, you're either going to be dismayed or angry. And I'm trying to say, you are the bad guys. Now we've got to cope with it. Now, there's a whole conversation in the US and the UK and Australia around, have we moved? As Tim Keller says, we're in a neutral world. Aaron Wren's book, Life in a Negative World. But I don't want us to react. Aaron Wren's book is very good, by the way, and partly because he doesn't work in a church. He's worked in public settings and public sphere policy. And he's saying, here's what it's like. I don't think we should be not winsome isn't a strategy, but it has to be a stance because I don't think you can out winsome. You're just not going to get away from our theological framework. We can't play bait and switch. And so I'm wanting to say in this book, just own our stuff. We have divergent views from the mainstream culture now about what human flourishing is about, what sexuality and gender are about. And the average non-Christian doesn't hate on us because they know lots of Christians. But big C Christianity is on the nose. So they might say, I can't stand the church. And they're having a pint with you and some mates at the pub. And then they look at you and go, oh, not you. You're okay. And you go, how do you put those two things together? And they assume that you're probably softer on a lot of issues because they've never asked you. And you know what you don't want them to do? Ask you because you're scared to
Yeah.
give the answer.
Can we drill down to that example a bit more? What do you recommend? Because I think that's a really good example where there's this assumption, oh, we're all sort of on the same page here, aren't we? We're all friends. And those people have a perception of you that you are in a different place to where you actually are, and you hold to some difficult Orthodox traditional Christian stuff, and you basically have no idea how to engage your friends on that, or whether you should even touch it. And can I maybe just get you with the gospel without having to talk about sexuality? You know, what's your advice for people in those sorts of situations?
Yeah, what I would say is the first thing you want to do is listen to what your friend might be asking you, and then maybe ask them a question or two first before you start to answer it. And also say, look, if you're asking me these questions, I'm going to explain things to you from a paradigm that you probably no longer believe. So you're going to read them in a way that it is different to how I might be saying it. But I want to explain to you a world that what I believe about these things and what you believe about these things aren't simply on a spectrum. They're two very different operating systems. And the Christian operating system I'm going to talk to you about is long and old and has tradition in it. And the one you hold is pretty new. So the first thing you'd want to do is say to them, I want you to come to this as a humble listening conversation. Because if you can't, we're not going to be able to have a conversation. So I always say, start asking people what is the question behind their question. Our apologetics is very quick to give answers, but I say, just hold on. And then be wise as serpents and as harmless as doves. And find out what they're asking and why they're asking it. If someone's asking you a question because they want to know the reason for the hope that's within you, give it. If you think that perhaps they're asking you for the bigotry that's within you and why you believe it, be cautious. So I would say put on your Arnie Terminator 2 spectacles, scan the room that you're in. If it is a bar, then you're just channeling Terminator 2 anyway, and just say, why are they asking that? Where are they coming from? And what's this about? And I've just spent the weekend in Sydney at a church for their weekend away, being the speaker. The great Reformed Anglican Church in Sydney that lives in the heart of Mardi Gras territory. And 2 weekends ago in Sydney, you can imagine what Sydney Mardi Gras is like. And they're handing out water and food and speaking to people about the gospel on the night. And they can hold those two things in tension. And it gets them sort of a punch in the mouth occasionally, but it also gets them people coming along occasionally. And you go, not more than occasionally, actually. Somehow being the bad guy means you might get a hit, but you'll also be different enough that people would say, who are looking for something might say, there's something different about this.
Yeah. And I'd love to talk a bit more about that kind of cultural engagement. It strikes me in hearing your story of between Belfast and Australia and the cultural differences that right from the beginning of your life there's been that kind of not just an interest in cultural differences, but you've actually lived it and having ministered all over the world in different kinds of churches, and even beyond the church world, I know you have a kind of keen interest in lots of things outside the kind of Christian and theological bubble. That you're really, I think, interested and passionate about engaging with the world as it is. And so that example with the church going along to Mardi Gras and being kind of salt and light is a good example of that need for Christians to get outside of our four walls of the church sometimes and actually engage with the world as it is and find those connection points. It's not easy to do at all, but it strikes me as something that you're very interested in, and a lot of you, and it comes through in a lot of your writing, that you want to help us as the church kind of engage better with the world. And as you say, even if we are the bad guys, isn't entirely a negative message because, of course, for most of church history, that's been the case, and the church has grown, and in fact, the church tends to grow in places where it's most persecuted. So it's not that it's all bad news.
No, look, and I'm not dissing on nominalism. Two cheers for nominalism, I say, because there are plenty of non-Christians who go, what is going on? The place seems like it's all up. I don't know what people believe anymore and what they believe. I'm a big enough believer in natural law, and to say bad ideas will eventually not work. But I'm never naive enough to say that if you don't live the way Jesus told you to, your life will fall apart, because I'm not just about human flourishing, because the gospel says that we suffer as well. The other thing is, everyone suffers at some stage, and you can craft any life you like and live any way you like. But if suffering comes along, it really asks you some serious questions about what you really think the meaning of life is and what's the purpose and point. And it's in those points, as you know, C.S. Lewis talks about God's megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Pain and suffering. And I'm a big fan of Nick Cave, who lives in your neck of the woods, but is from my neck of the woods. Suffering has made him ask some serious questions about God and made him a great, in this secular age, a great prophet who's sort of, he's not Christian as such, but he straddles those two worlds with a deep honesty because of his suffering. And I think suffering is going to be the thing that people start to look at and say, how come this meaning and purpose, thing that I'm doing isn't working when suffering happens? The gospel answers the suffering question in a way that nothing else can.
Do you have examples of that from your own life?
Yeah, I think I do. I had severe pancreatitis in my early 40s at the point where our church plant was failing, some relationships in a wider network were falling apart. And I remember lying in a bed with a major surgery, unable to move for 2 weeks. And I'd been told you might die. And I remember a Sovereign Grace song in my head saying that where God says, you've stripped me of everything I'd depend, I've stripped, God, you stripped me of everything I'd depend on, so I'd depend on you. And you took away everything I would lean on, so I would lean on you. Without the gospel at that point, what had I? Nothing. But it's in the suffering that my wife said to me after that, if I'd seen the last 2 years coming, I wouldn't have wanted them. But on the other side of them, we couldn't have done without them. And suffering changed us as a couple. It softened us, made us more like Jesus, and made us more accessible to other people's suffering, even people who we don't agree with. And I think there's something in that. And look, it's changed my preaching. There's a great Huffington Post article that I can't remember the name of the guy who said it, but he said, all things considered, the Bible is a book written by losers for the benefit of other losers. That's not a value judgment, just an observation. And I laughed and I thought, if there's truth to it, exiled, slave-ridden people who are on the The edges and margins of the community, and the prophets are hiding in caves, and the people of God are suffering, and God has something to say in the midst of it, and we have a suffering Savior. And the Bible story is always suffer now, glory later. And joy in the suffering, no doubt, but it's suffer now, glory later. And it made me think, what if I put on the suffering now, glory later spectacles as I come to the text of the Bible, and not use the Bible as prescription for how I can get politics to do what I want, but how to live as an exiled community waiting for home. And if we could help our younger people figure that out, maybe they wouldn't fall away in droves thinking, I've got to have it all now.
Yeah. You mentioned politics. It brings us nicely on to Future Proof, which is your follow-up book, How to Live for Jesus in a Culture that Keeps on Changing. And there was loads of fantastic stuff in the book I could pull out. But one of the things that I actually wrote an editorial based on was your point around politics in that book. And I'd love to talk about it some more. This idea that in a lot of the West, we've made politics into an idol. Can you explain that kind of concept for us and why it's relevant?
Yeah. Yeah, look, I remember Douglas Murray's book, The Madness of Crowd, that he said there's no safety net below us for forgiveness because we don't have a forgiveness culture anymore. You fall through. But I wanted to flip that too and say there's no safety net above us of a transcendent view of God above. And something must take its place. It's like a reverse game of Tetris. The line above falls out and something pushes up. And that's politics. And post-Christian politics is kind of secularism in its sense. Is a kind of Christian heresy. It still wants the idea of a progressive future where things are going to soon and very soon, a great future is coming, but it wants it politically. And so the language of politics is no longer just right and wrong, it's good and bad. The people in politics are no longer left and right, but they're saints and sinners. And it becomes a zero-sum game. It becomes hot religious. And the Queen's funeral was the last great political moment that said there's a buffer between politics and the transcendent, and it's God. God is the transcendent one, not politics. And it was a deliberate attempt by the late Queen to dial everyone's hubris down. And I think we've got a lot of hubris in politics, and we've got a lot of win at all costs in politics, precisely because we don't see ourselves as living under a king. And Paul could see it, even in Rome. You fear, you honor the king, but you fear God. God is above, and no political position is given it except that the king above gives it. Once you take the safety net out, politics will do anything.
Yeah, and it's a striking message, I think, given there are so many nations around the world where it's a election year.
Yeah.
To remember that politics is not everything. And it's tricky because I think for us as Christians, there's been a push, I think rightly in the UK, to encourage Christians to be more politically engaged, which I think is good, and pray for politicians and consider not just shouting from the sidelines, but getting more involved. But I think what was great about your book is it just brought a helpful balance to that, to say, remember, this is not everything. And there is another kingdom here. And as you say, if you take God out the picture completely, you are then just left with, well, the only way we get progress is through politics, and that becomes our God and everything we invest in. Whereas for us as Christians, there is a much greater hope. And I guess this brings us back to the title of the book, Future Proof. This idea that the political system can do what it likes, the church will endure.
Yes, and look, I want us to be politically involved, and I've got friends who are senior people in the Australian Parliament. And I spent time in Canberra working with some of those people. So I want us to be politically involved, but it's the church that will continue. And the church is a polis itself. It's a place where the king is different to the king outside the church. And so it's what I call an alternate ethical society. And I think that's what the key for me is, how do you, in the political turmoil that we've got, say, no, my hope isn't that my person gets into parliament, because it's going to, sometimes they will and sometimes they won't. But focusing on the gospel among God's people and then doing what I can, whether I'm a politician, whether I'm a lawyer, whether I'm a factory worker, whether I'm a laborer, whether I'm a tradie, whatever I am, I will live in such a way in this polis that it pushes out into the rest of the world where I can and makes a difference. And the church has God's spirit holding it together, and it will be there on the last day. And I wanted to encourage Christians not to get into quietism and withdrawal, but to live in the church in such a way that the church sends them out into the world to live in, as Mark Sayers, another Australian in a very secular city of Melbourne, says, is a non-anxious presence. And I've seen people ask lots of questions of Christians around the fact that they're not anxious in what is the most anxious age we've lived in since, you know, well, since the plague. You know, it feels like for all we have, anxiety is through the roof.
What do you think are the major pressures for the church in the West at the moment? You know, what are the areas where you think these are the dangers where we're not getting it right, or these are the, or even these are the biggest opportunities for the church right now?
Yeah, well, there's a whole bunch. I mean, shameless plug, in the second half of the book, I kind of unpack some of those day-to-day things. The technology issues, massive. Where is technology taking us? We're always reacting to it. We don't know how to engage with it. The new AI is going to be interesting. Our kids are hooked on, you know, Twitter or whatever. Or people are hooked on porn. Technology has invaded our lives in such a sense that I don't say to people, hey, how's Babylon going to be tomorrow morning? You carry Babylon around in your back pocket. And it shapes us. We're distracted. I think that's a big issue. I think the other issues are polarization, autonomy, the sense that we live through our technologies in such a way that atomize us. But I don't think it's just the bad life. I think the good life will take us away from Jesus just as much as the bad life. So I'm seeing a thinning out of attendance at church. So go back to the start. This feels a good way of rounding things around. Week in, week out, church. Low grade, slow grade, slow cooked church changes you in ways that you cannot imagine. And if you say, well, we're going to this service one week and next week we're not really going to go because we're going to the holiday house, and the week after that we've got a sport event on, so we'll go to the service that we don't normally go to, or we don't know people, and don't be surprised if your teenagers don't end up Christian, because you've shown them a vision of human flourishing that doesn't really need Jesus. And they might not be going to Mardi Gras, but they won't have to leave Jesus behind. They could be just very successful, godless people. And your biggest trap will be that. So I don't want to paint scary pictures of, you know, sort of pagan Rome again and everyone in togas. I want to say a good, sensible life without Jesus is just as damning. And we could pitch people for that if we're not careful.
Yeah, it's a sobering thought, isn't it? But as you say, the positive spin on that is just that, I think you called it the low grade, slow grade, going to the same church week in, week out, even when when you don't feel like you get anything out of it, it is doing you good.
Yeah, look, I think I mentioned in my first book, a running friend of mine who's a lapsed Irish Catholic, she said to me, and we run lots of kilometres together when you're marathon training, she said, I envy you Christians. I said, oh, you can't envy us Christians. You're a lapsed Irish Catholic. You've got to hate us. And she goes, no. She said, you do community in ways that I couldn't imagine. When COVID happened, it was just like you just knew how to live and help each other. I said, yeah, because we didn't have to do anything extra, as in a new norm. We just dialed up slightly what we were already doing. And she had nothing like that. She felt her communities were good time communities, but when bad times happened, they didn't know how to rally around. When unforgiveness happened, they didn't have a forgiveness framework. It just fractured. And the Christian community is future-proof because God says it is. But as Tim Keller said in his last article before he died in The Atlantic, the online journal, you know, the church in America even is due for a revival. And history hasn't shown that secularism has just inexorably won the day. It's a roller coaster. And the front cover of my book is actually pitched at that history goes all over the place. And you will be anxious about it if you don't have a North Star towards which you are directed. And I think the church is being pulled into the future by the power of the Holy Spirit to the last day and the new creation. And that's our hope. We have direction and hope and someone guiding us in a world that seems all over the place.
A lovely place to leave it. Stephen McAlpine, thank you so much for being our guest on The Profile this week.
I love being with you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity Magazine.